días.
Guten Tag.
Buongiorno. Bonjour. Ohayou gozaimasu. Dobroyo utro.
Karimera.
G'day.
Welcome to Wider Horizons, a program devoted to exploring different points of view on what we believe. What we believe about the world around us and any other worlds, about human nature and who we are, and about the relationships among humans, between humans and the natural world, and between humans and any spiritual world. I'm your guide for this journey, Nick Schweitzer, no more qualified to lead this than many of you are, but interested and willing to do so. This is the first of six lectures on world religions, coordinated by the Reverend Michael Schuller of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Madison, presented at Oakwood Village, starting on October 4th, 2007. October 4th was a Thursday, and the day of the week is noteworthy in itself, because the names of the days of the week in English reveal traces of mythologies and belief systems that have largely disappeared from modern life. Thursday was originally Donnerstag, the day of the Germanic thunder god, now known as Thor. It was followed by Friday, which was originally Freya's Tag, the day of the Germanic goddess of love, Freya. For more information about this series of lectures, or about the citywide low-power FM station and its programming, visit citywidelpfm.org.
I think we're about ready to commence this afternoon. Thank you all for being here. I'm Mike Schuller. For those of you that don't know me, I'm the parish minister of the First Unitarian Society. Post that I've occupied responsibilities I've fulfilled for almost 20 years now. I'm happy to be able to give Oakwood residents an opportunity to learn something about the world's great religions. We've organized six presentations, six consecutive weeks, covering Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism, but commencing really with what we might think of as one of the most important precursors of all of these great religions, the more earth-centered feminist traditions that are associated with the indigenous cultures before the religions of the book even began to emerge. And so we've invited Nick Schweitzer to share with us some of his knowledge about these very early traditions, traditions which continue to inform the world's great religions today. And Nick is a member of the First Unitarian Society, and he's been around there a bit longer than actually I have. He's also an administrative judge in the City of Madison, a member of the Madison Literary Society, and has had a long time interest in these kinds of issues, and we're looking forward to this presentation.
Thank you, Michael. It's very good to see all of you here today. I was actually expecting a smaller setting and a smaller number of people. I was hoping we could talk a little bit among ourselves. That may be a little difficult. But once I've presented some of this information, I hope there'll be time for not only questions to me, but your own comments and observations. When Michael set up this class, he gave it the title, The Feminine Principle in Pre-Patriarchal Religion, which is about six words too long for me. I call it simply, Before God. And I'm always a little concerned in speaking to a group like this, many of you are retired from positions, some of them academic, because I always worry that there's someone in the audience who knows the subject better than I do. So if that's true, when we do get to questions, please offer your observations and your corrections in a kindly tone. I would actually love to ask each of you what your current image or non-image is of God. But I suspect that in this room there are many, many different nuanced versions of what God is or maybe even a goddess. And when I teach an adult education class at the First Unitarian Society called Building Your Own Theology, We spend a lot of time talking about God images, and it can take up a whole class period. So just one setup question to you right now. What is the conventional image of God? It is of an old gray-haired man, right? It is a male image, undoubtedly. Now, the images of power in our society are, with very few exceptions, male. Until very recently, and for thousands of years, women in Western society were assigned the responsibilities for the activities of daily life. And women with power, like Joan of Arc, or Empress Catherine of Russia, or Elizabeth I of England, were extremely rare. I'm going to take you to a very different place. Only a few thousands of years ago, where the ordinary activities of daily life were the responsibility of all, but the wielder of power, especially extraordinary power, was the woman. It was a time when nature was still a source of great power, of mystery, mysterious power, not simply a nuisance to be tamed and controlled as it is today. And women were viewed as being more closely tied to nature than men were. Women had a mysterious and mystical connection to the heavens, especially to the rhythm of the moon. Their monthly periods followed the moon, and in that mysterious process, women could lose blood without dying. And even more mysterious and more powerful, women could create new life. I'll be talking about the status of women back when they were revered as something akin to goddesses. Tens of thousands of years ago, humans were in closer contact every day and communion with the earth. Like women, the earth also brought forth life. And the phrase Mother Earth or Mother Nature undoubtedly started way back then. That's all changed now, of course. Much of the mystery of nature is gone because it can be explained by natural forces. And somewhere along the way, as a corollary to the demotion of nature, woman was pulled down from her throne. And even though certain societies have pretended to put her on a pedestal, women have most recently been the most powerless creatures in the world. I'll talk a bit about when that change happened and how it happened and why it happened. A lot of the information I'll be presenting can be found in either one of two books here. One is called The Creation of Patriarchy, written by Gerda Lerner. Some of you perhaps know Professor Lerner personally. The other is When God Was a Woman, which is a little bit more popularized version of it, but it's fascinating. The archaeological record starts in the Paleolithic, popularly called the Stone Age, in what is now Central Europe and what we now call the Middle East. And when the Stone Age turned into the Age of Agriculture, called the Neolithic period, those changes happened especially in the Middle East, what we now consider to have been the cradle of our civilization. In the Great Triangle from the mouth of the Nile, north to the Black Sea, and southeast to the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates. On today's map, it stretches from Egypt, north through Palestine and Israel, and Lebanon and Syria to Turkey, and then southeast through Iraq. This is coincidentally the exact area which seems to have the most intractable political problems these days. Some of the locations in this area that I'll mention are Jericho, Ur, Katalhuyuk, and Hasilar. Starting about 25,000 years ago, all through the Middle East and Central Europe, from Spain to Russia, what we find in the archaeological record are human figurines, almost all of them women. One of the earliest, and probably the most famous, was found in Willendorf in Austria, and it has been nicknamed the Venus of Willendorf. I've included a copy of that illustration. These statuettes depict maternal figures with well-developed hips and breasts, which may indicate pregnancy or perhaps just well-fed, robust health. Scholars are divided over whether the female figures are goddesses, or ancestors, or clan mothers, but they all acknowledge that the objects represented in the sculptures are overwhelmingly women, and that the figures appear over a period of more than 10,000 years. Other examples from 20,000 to 25,000 years ago were found at Kostienki in Ukraine, in Russia, at Dolny Vestorice in Moravia, Czechoslovakia, and at Lozelle, France, the latter being a bas-relief sculpture rather than a figure. The figurines of women continued throughout the Stone Age, during which human culture was characterized by small tribes of hunter-gatherers. And the figurines continued well into the next stage of human culture, during which animals like sheep and goats were domesticated, and simple agriculture led to larger social groupings and permanent settlements, a period known as the Neolithic, which began about 9,000 years ago in certain areas in the Middle East. The art in the Neolithic cultures continued to be dominated by statuettes of women, along with some animal carvings. The female figurines become much more slender and artistic, with less emphasis on breasts and hips and general massiveness. They may have represented goddesses, but they may also have represented real religious and social and political leaders who were women. There are many examples of these. I've included a few. Among the most famous are the Nile goddess and a figurine from the Greek Cycladic Islands, those islands to the west, to the east of Greece that include Santorini, Mykonos, and Delos, and the Minoan snake goddess, one of Arthur Evans' most spectacular finds at Knossos in Crete. Just in case any of you would like to have your own reproductions of these. There is a company that sells them. JBL Devotional Statues specializes in reproductions of goddess statues. Again, it is difficult to know if these represent goddesses or clan leaders or rulers, but after the invention of writing, the stories that begin to be written down talk about goddesses. And it is from these stories that we know about Isis in Egypt, Ishtar in Mesopotamia, also called Inanna, Astarte in Canaan, also called Ashtoreth or Asherah, who later probably became Aphrodite in Greece. Incidentally, the word Asherah, which appears in the Bible, also referred to a sacred tree or pole that either stood near the shrines to Asherah or was simply placed by itself to honor her. And there are many references to tearing down Asherahs. Besides Aphrodite in Greece were Gaia, Rhea, Hera. In one of the earliest written Greek records, the Homeric hymns, written in the 7th or 6th century BC, there is a hymn to the mother goddess titled Hymn to Gaia, Mother of All. Now, I just used the phrase BC as an aside. I could use BCE, and some of you, I'm sure, are comfortable with that for the common era. And it's perhaps a little more politically correct among certain circles these days, but I will continue to use the abbreviations BC and AD, mostly because most people grew up with them and are more familiar with them, and they're just easier to say. Now, in the country of Phrygia, which is in north-central Turkey, or as it was then called, Anatolia, Cybele was worshipped as the Great Mother. And there were many places in Anatolia where the worship of women lingered on into historic times, where we have written records of them. In fact, I was reading a book just a couple weeks ago, and I ran across a reference. When the Persians tried for a second time to invade Greece in 480 BC, 10 years after having been defeated in the Battle of Marathon, one of the Persian king's commanders was Artemisia, the queen of Halicarnassus. It is a city on the seacoast of Anatolia. And she was, in fact, the only commander singled out for honor after the Persians' disastrous defeat in the sea battle at Salamis. Here I'd like to just indulge in one of my own flights of imagination. And it's related to the Iliad and the story of Helen of Troy. I have long been troubled by Helen's motivation in running away from Sparta to Troy, even if she did fall in love with Paris. My theory is that in addition to finding true love, she found a society that accepted her more. Troy was a city in Anatolia. I expect that they still worshiped the goddess and held women in high regard, while all of Greece at that time, and especially Sparta, was in the grip of the new male-oriented religion, which I'll speak about in a minute, under which women were little better than slaves. Here's a passage that was written in the 2nd century AD about all of these goddesses. It was written by the Roman writer Apuleius in the first person, as if it were the goddess herself speaking. I am nature, the universal mother, mistress of all elements, primordial child of time, sovereign of all things spiritual, queen of the dead, queen also of the immortals, the single manifestation of all gods and goddesses that are. My nod governs the shining heights of heaven, the wholesome sea breezes, the lamentable silences of the world below. Though I am worshipped in many aspects, and known by countless names, and propitiated with all manner of different rites, yet the whole round earth venerates me. The Phrygians call me Hesynuntica, mother of the gods. The Athenians call me Artemis. For the islanders of Cyprus, I am Aphrodite. For the archers of Crete, I am Dictyna. For the Sicilians, Proserpine. And for the Elestinians, their ancient mother of corn. Some know me as Hera. Some as Bellona of the battles. Some as Hecate. Some as Rhamnubia. But the races of Ethiopians and the Egyptians call me by my true name, which is Isis. She had a lot of names. They seem to have sprung from the places in which she was worshipped. But she somehow represented the same thing in these people's minds. The Neolithic period, during which all these goddesses were worshipped, witnessed tremendous changes in human culture. The development of agriculture, ceramics, textiles, town building, laws and governments, wheeled vehicles, and written languages. In fact, the earliest examples of written language found so far are Sumerian, and they are accounting records from the Temple of Inanna in Uruk from approximately 3000 BC. A site that has been described as the first settled city is Katalhöyük in the interior of what is now Turkey. Katalhöyük was inhabited for 1,000 years. At least 40 shrines to female figures have been unearthed, the oldest dating from about 6,500 BC. According to one writer, the principal deity of the city was a goddess who is shown in all three aspects as a young woman, a mother giving birth, and as an old woman. In the graves that have been found, there are many more burials of women than of men. And the deep red pigmented clay called ochre was strewn over the bodies of the women, but not the men. By the year 7000 BC, at the site now known as Jericho, in what was then Canaan, people were living in plastered brick houses with clay ovens and chimneys. And there were many rectangular plaster shrines with small clay figures of the mother goddess type. A quote from another researcher says, "Female clay figures with their hands raised to their breast resemble idols of the mother goddess which were later so widely disseminated in the Near East." Similar figures of the goddess have been found in excavations at the city of Hasselar in central Anatolia, which was inhabited about 6,800 BC. Robert Graves, you may recognize that name. He was a British poet, novelist, nonfiction writer, especially about myths. You may know him as the author of I, Claudius. He wrote, "The whole of Neolithic Europe, to judge from the surviving artifacts and myths, had a remarkably homogeneous system of religious beliefs based on the many-titled Mother Goddess. The great goddess was regarded as immortal, changeless, omnipotent. The concept of fatherhood had not yet been introduced into religious thought." No one knows for certain why male gods replaced females as the object of veneration and worship. The most popular theory is that the peace-loving, agricultural, and earth-centered peoples of the Middle East were conquered by invaders from the north, probably nomadic raiders called Indo-Europeans, who brought with them a male-dominated culture and male gods. The arrival of invaders from the north is recorded in the archaeological record starting around 2400 BC. But one reason the record isn't clear is that in most places the female deities were not simply wiped out, but assimilated in different ways in different places. At times, the females acquired a son, or a brother, or a lover, or a consort. Sometimes the recently arrived male married the female, who had ruled the area for centuries or millennia. This happened, I believe, with Zeus and Hera. Hera became, in popular mythology, Zeus's wife. And in the stories that survive as they fought, when they fought, as they often did, she sometimes won by guile, but he was capable of lording it over her handily by sheer strength. There are two passages in the Iliad that refer very specifically to this. At the end of book one of the Iliad, Hera's son, Hephaestus, tries to smooth over one of the many disagreements between Zeus and Hera, who favored opposite sides in the Trojan War. The following passage will sound familiar to anyone who has worked with families in which abuse has touched both the wife and children. Following the argument, it says, "On this, Hera was frightened, so she curbed her stubborn will and sat down in silence. But the heavenly beings were disquieted throughout the house of Zeus till Hephaestus began to try to pacify his mother. 'It will be intolerable,' said he, 'if you two fall to wrangling and setting heaven in an uproar about a pack of mortals. If such ill counsels are to prevail, we shall have no pleasure at our banquet. Let me then advise my mother, and she must herself know that it would be better, to make friends with my dear father Zeus, lest he again scold her and disturb our feast. If the Olympian thunderer wants to hurl us all from our seats, he can do so, for he is far the strongest. So give him fair words, and he will then soon be in a good humor with us.' As he spoke, he took a double cup of nectar and placed it in his mother's hand. 'Cheer up, my dear mother,' said he, 'and make the best of it. I love you dearly, and should be very sorry to see you get a thrashing. However grieved I might be, I could not help, for there is no standing against Zeus. Once before, when I was trying to help you, he caught me by the foot and flung me from the heavenly threshold. All day long, from morn till eve, was I falling, till at sunset I came to ground." And even more chilling is the second passage, the beginning of book 15, after Zeus discovers that Hera did something against his will. "The father of gods and men looked fiercely on Hera. 'I see, Hera,' said he, 'you mischief-making trickster, that your cunning has stayed Hector from fighting and has caused the rout of this host. I am in half a mind to thrash you, in which case you will be the first to reap the fruits of your scurvy knavery. Do not you remember how once upon a time I had you hanged? I fastened two anvils onto your feet and bound your hands in a chain of gold which none could break, and you hung in midair among the clouds. All of the gods in Olympus were in a fury, but they could not reach you to set you free. When I caught any of them, I hurled him and gripped him and hurled him from the heavenly threshold till he came fainting down to earth. I would remind you of this, that you may learn to leave off being so deceitful." not exactly a married bliss. Now, the actual sequence of historical events in Greece, the usurpation of power by this incoming male god, is illustrated very well by an institution you know, the Olympics. As you know, games in honor of Zeus were held every 4 years at Olympia. And the statue of Zeus at Olympia was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Only men were allowed to compete in the Olympic Games. But if you visit Olympia, you will notice a temple to Hera, about half the size of the temple of Olympian Zeus, occupying a more central location. The temple to Hera is actually quite a bit older than Zeus's, and it is an accepted fact at the site, although not well known elsewhere, that the original games in Olympia were run by young women in honor of Hera, long before they were appropriated by Zeus. Other goddesses in the Middle East either accepted male gods as their consorts or became consorts of the god. Ishtar became associated with the god Tammuz. The legends surrounding Ishtar are quite confusing to my mind, but in one version he was her lover, she caused his death, and then she descended into the underworld to bring him back to life. Isis became both the sister and the wife of Osiris. And Asherah became the consort of the god El in Canaan. There are even a few very rare inscriptions, not in the Bible, but on fragments of clay tablets that refer to Asherah as the consort of Yahweh. There's an article in the March 2005 issue of Archaeology magazine that describes these finds, titled The Lost Goddess of Israel. Robert Graves, again, in his work The Greek Myths, wrote, "Invasions of the 13th century BC seriously weakened the matrilineal tradition, and when the Dorians arrived toward the close of the second millennium, patrilineal succession became the rule." Now, if marriage wasn't a solution, another alternative was rape. And you probably know the legend of Persephone, or Proserpine, who was carried off to the underworld by Hades against her will. Her mother, Demeter, already mentioned as the goddess of corn for the Eleusinians, mourned Persephone and refused to let crops and vegetation grow again until a bargain was reached with Hades to release Persephone from the underworld. I could continue telling that story, which many of you undoubtedly know, pomegranate seeds and all, but the Greek myths have a way of going on, and I could get off track here easily. Now, if marriage and rape weren't sufficient, the god could simply murder the goddess. This happened at Delphi, which had been the site of female prophetesses for centuries, but which Apollo, a relatively late addition to the Greek pantheon, coveted for himself. He is said to have fought a battle with the guardian of the temple there, referred to as the snake, Python, which is nevertheless generally considered to represent a female. Apollo won, naturally, and he established his temple at Delphi. Interestingly, he still allowed women to be the prophetesses, and they were referred to as the Pythia. I will briefly mention two other theories about the transition from goddesses to gods, because they are at least thought-provoking, although far from proven or accepted. The second, the next theory, which is not incompatible with the conquest theory I just mentioned, is that once humans developed agriculture and settled down into permanent settlements, the men lost their vocation as hunters. They became idle and unsatisfied as farmers, and turned their adrenaline and their testosterone to wars against outsiders and competition within, using their physical strength to dominate others, including women. And they eventually took over the realms of power that had previously belonged to the women. The third theory, which may be a little crackpot, but it's not incompatible with the other two, has a few things that I like. It's put forth in a book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. And it focuses on two different ways of thinking, the two halves of the human brain. The right brain, which is more image-oriented and holistic, versus the left half, which is more analytical and linear. You will remember that writing was developed during this period, and the author's theory is that men gained an advantage when societies began to use alphabets, ways of writing that required linear thinking, and it worked better with their left brains. This may have combined, at least marginally, with the other two forces. But regardless of which of these theories, or another one perhaps, best explains it, what is known is that goddess worship essentially disappeared from the Middle East at this time. It took centuries, but it waned under the influence of the male-dominated religions. Now, there is one place in the Middle East, one specific culture, where the goddess was not gently nudged aside, or married, or even forcibly raped in submission. She was systematically exterminated, along with all the people who believed in her. And you have an idea of which culture I'm referring to. Did any of you bring your Bibles today? It is Judaism. Judaism is a fiercely monotheistic, male-oriented religion. Even so, the books of the Bible still contain evidence of Yahweh's struggle for power over other gods and goddesses. What is the first commandment? You shall have no other gods before me, or beside me, depending on the translation. Why was it necessary to have that as the first commandment? There are many passages that describe Yahweh's wrath when his people worship other gods or goddesses. I will read you a few of them. In Exodus chapter 23, God is speaking. My angel will go ahead of you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, and Jebusites, and I will wipe them out. Do not bow down before their gods, or worship them, or follow their practices. You must demolish them and break their sacred stones to pieces. There are passages in Judges. In fact, this same passage is repeated a number of times. In chapter 10, for example, it says, again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They served the Baals and the Ashtoreths, and the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines, and they forsook the Lord and no longer served him. I actually have quite a few. I'll only read a couple more. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, it says, again, God speaking, destroy completely all the places on the high mountains and on the hills and under every spreading tree where the nations you are dispossessing worship their gods. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, and burn their Asherah poles in the fire. Cut down the idols of their gods and wipe out their names from those places. One passage from Joshua 23. If you violate the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, the Lord's anger will burn against you and you will quickly perish from the good land he has given you. In fact, almost the entire book of Joshua is one long catalog of cities and cultures that the warlike Israelites wiped out completely. In chapter 11 it says, Joshua took all these royal cities and their kings and put them to the sword. He totally destroyed them, as Moses the servant of the Lord had commanded. The Israelites carried off for themselves all the plunder and livestock of these cities, but all the people they put to the sword until they completely destroyed them, not sparing anything that breathed. Now there's just one other passage, which is a slightly less miserable one. In Jeremiah, there's a reference to the Queen of Heaven. And once again, God is berating his people, but this passage is so much lighter that I want to make sure you see it. In Jeremiah, once at chapter 7 and again in chapter 44, it says something like, the children gather wood, the fathers light the fire, and the women knead the dough and make cakes of bread for the Queen of Heaven. They pour out drink offerings to other gods to provoke me to anger. Now, the Bible itself provides some of the most convincing support for the first theory of displacement. That is, that she, in all her forms, was simply supplanted by a male god who insisted on the people worshiping him to the exclusion of any worship of the female. If you believe the historical and archaeological record, a person named Abraham probably lived around 1500 to 1800 BC. And if you accept the fact that humanity has been around a lot longer than that, the question becomes, where was the God of the Old Testament before he appeared to Abraham at that time? Just to show you that the worship of the goddess did continue for a while into historic times, there's a reference in the book of Acts, chapter 19. I won't read it for you. It's a long passage, but it basically relates Paul's experience in the city of Ephesus, where he preaches against the goddess, Artemis. And the local people rise up against him and say, not only, well, the temple of the great goddess Artemis is discredited, the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world, will be robbed of her divine majesty. This goes to an assembly. The person in charge of the assembly basically says, stop the argument. Take it to the court system if you want to. And Paul leaves Ephesus shortly afterwards. In the end, the Christian religion ultimately doomed goddess worship. Once the Roman emperors converted to Christianity, they began enforcing the commandments of the Jewish Old Testament not to have any other gods, and they began to suppress the worship of all other gods and goddesses. In about 300 AD, the Christian emperor Constantine suppressed the worship of Ashtoreth in Canaan. In 380 AD, the emperor Theodosius closed temples to the goddess in Rome, especially ones to Isis, closed the temple of the goddess at Ephesus, and the temple of Artemis in Ephesus, the one which gave Paul such a hard time. And converted all the remaining temples of Isis into Christian churches, and the last temple dedicated to a goddess was finally closed down or demolished in 500 AD. Since that time, the worship of the goddess has been ruthlessly persecuted in Western society. You undoubtedly know that hundreds of thousands were put to death over the centuries for engaging or in pagan or earth-based practices or worship of goddesses. Witches were burned, of course. Nevertheless, the goddess has never disappeared entirely. Many people see her continued influence in the figure of Mary in Christian religions, especially the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church does not permit the worship of Mary, only her veneration. But consider how she is venerated. Most of the largest and best-known cathedrals in Europe were named and dedicated not to Christ, or the Father, or the Holy Spirit, but to Notre Dame, Our Lady. Those in Paris, Rouen, Amiens, Chartres, Antwerp. There are others, such as the cathedral in Cologne, that are dedicated to Mary, along with someone else. In Cologne's case, it's St. Peter and Mary. The implication I draw is that only in that way would the populace contribute enough for the construction and support of the temple. Some scholars think that a veneration of Mary, the veneration of Mary in the Christian religion, was a direct response by the church fathers to the worship of Isis, which was widespread, especially in Rome at the time. Such a ploy would have allowed the Catholic Church to absorb a large number of people who had believed in Isis, and who would not have accepted the new religion without an Isis-like female figure for their faith. Some of the representations of Isis, as you can see, holding or suckling the child Horus, are strikingly similar to representations of Mary and the Christ child. It can also be argued that the goddess, the feminine, continues to be worshipped in today's earth-based religions, which are enjoying at least a modest renewal. I ran across one description of neo-paganism that says, Wiccans and other pagans worship the mother goddess. Most commonly, she is worshipped as the triple goddess, the maiden, the mother, and the crone. This is a vastly oversimplified view of pagans today, some of whom attempt to recreate ancient practices, some of whom are creating new practices. Nevertheless, there is certainly an earth-based focus and a greater respect for the feminine in the modern-day pagan movement. This is certainly a subject worthy of its own lecture, but I mention it here to show that there is continuity with the distant past in our reverence for Mother Nature and Mother Earth. Thank you. Now, would anyone like to ask a question or make a comment or start your own discussion? The question is, what did the original women do in these societies, presumably?
Now, the husbands would gather, the men would gather, and so did they cook the food in their ritual on the horse?
Well, of course, I wasn't there, so I'm not sure. But, and you said men were the gatherers. The traditional breakdown of tasks in societies like that is the men are the hunters, and the women are the gatherers. And that they would do the cooking and do more of still the child rearing. I don't know that I can tell you the roles of women in hunter-gatherer society beyond that. The assumption, though, is that they were viewed as having an innate power, and therefore they were probably the ones who were listened to in the councils and who made the decisions. But that's a speculation. Anyone in the audience have a better answer for what that is? You may know. Or another question.
You didn't say fire use or Northern Europe or Native Americans or South America.
You are absolutely right. The question was, or the comment was, that I didn't mention a number of other places in the world, Far East, the Americas, Northern Europe, etc., Africa. And I originally had a sentence in which I made that disclaimer. I took it out. But there are lots and lots of areas in the world where separate cultures developed. The Mesoamerican cultures and Mexico and the Central America I'm a little bit familiar with. I know too little about those, and I will simply make the statement that I don't know enough about those other cultures to say what the society was like and what the transition from one society to another was. Because our particular Judeo-Christian tradition, which most of us are at least familiar with, grew out of this area in the Middle East. It's the one where the research has led to conclusions that I understand. Now, have you looked at any of those other areas? Thank you. Well, it was strictly a question. I absolutely appreciate the question, and I acknowledge that I have left out a lot of the world. Michael?
Yeah, I'd just make a very brief comment, because I'm not an expert in this area either, but you do certainly find, if you look into cultures, which we will be in a few weeks, that there are several notable deities that seem to have characteristics of both male and female, which might suggest an earlier period of assimilation.
I'm just wondering if you look at the Hindu religion,
there seems to be evidence that maybe some of the principal deities in Hindu religion are either still explicitly female, like Kali, for instance, or they have both male and female qualities and characteristics, such as Vishnu. We also find that to be true in particularly Ramayana Buddhism, in which you have a bodhisattva figure, sitting a figure like Kuan Yin, that oftentimes is depicted as being female as opposed to male. So there's a pronounced feminine element in both those religions, but I suspect that you would find a pattern similar to what Nick described, that the feminine qualities of these religions were significantly greater in ancient times than they are today.
Yes.
Hawaiian culture.
The question was, wasn't Hawaiian culture matrilineal? And I don't know much about it, but I have heard that. Yes. It is my impression that even into very recent historical times, the succession of power was through the female line. Do you actually know more about it? Okay, once again, a question, but a question based on some familiarity with that subject. Yes.
What do anthropologists say about this? Because it seems to me that when you're talking about the Middle East, they have all of these a very similar situations where they're doctors, the female doctors, and they certainly not that much in direct contact with each other.
The question is actually, what do anthropologists say about this? And I don't know. Most of what I read in the books that have been written refers to archaeological excavations. And that's really, and so anthropologists would be extrapolating or simply imagining based on what they find. Aside from what I've told you about archaeological findings, I have never actually seen an anthropological article on this time period. Not to say that it isn't there, separate from the archaeological record. I don't know.
Yeah. One follow-up question. Would you say that the rise of monotheism is directly related to the suppression of female goddesses?
That is, the question was, would I say that the rise of monotheism has been directly related to the suppression of goddesses? And that's certainly the conclusion I've reached. And in fact, monotheism, the only monotheistic religions I'm aware of are male-dominated monotheistic religions. So it's a combination of male-oriented, single-god religions made the goddess religions unacceptable. That's the conclusion I've drawn. No other questions. Thank you very much.